Hello, and welcome to Agree to Differ, where we're going to give you a completely new way to understand a controversial issue and to decide where you stand. Often when it comes to debates in contested areas, the protagonists spend more time attacking and caricaturing each other than they do addressing the heart of the issue. In the studio, we have two people with strongly held opposing positions. Our aim is to discover what really divides them, and, just as important, is there anything they can agree on? George Monbiot and James Woodhouse are poles apart when it comes to the issue of fracking for shale gas. George Monbiot is perhaps one of the most well-known, some would say contentious, even combative, environmental campaigners in the country. A columnist with The Guardian, his career began here at the BBC as an investigative reporter with the Natural History Unit in 1985. Since he's left, he's written several best-selling books on environmental themes, including climate change, and has been involved in a variety of environmental direct action groups. James Woodhouse is Professor of Forecasting and Innovation at De Montfort University, Leicester. A physics graduate, he did postgraduate research in the political economy of nuclear energy and is the co-author of Energize, A Future for Energy Innovation. Apparently, the only things he doesn't forecast are the weather, stock markets, and the horses. Welcome both.
Thank you.
Hi.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you both to give us an opening statement of where you stand on fracking. But first, I want to find out a little bit more about what inspires you both. George, environmentalists are sometimes caricatured as tree huggers, but that's actually how you started out, isn't it?
Well, my first environmental direct action, I think I was about 8 years old, was on this bit of scrubby common outside our house where this man wanted to cut down a hollow tree where green woodpeckers nested. And I was mad about natural history from long before I can remember. And I used to go out and watch the green woodpeckers and watch the babies sticking their heads out of the hole to be fed by the parents. It was captivating. It was a wonderful thing. And so I literally hung on to this tree to try to stop him doing so. And I stayed there all the way from about 11 o'clock till lunchtime. And then I went home for lunch, being the good boy that I was, and came back, and of course it was in ruins, which was an important lesson in life. And the sense of indignation and fury and upset of that moment, I can still feel it today. And it's come back in many different forms since then.
James, you too developed a passion early on, but for you it wasn't so much nature as technology, the space race.
Yeah, well, I was known at school as Woody Woodpecker, and I grew up with pets, so I've always, you know, liked animals and still like them and nature. But it was the Gagarin circuit of the Earth and the Apollo mission, and before those, Telstar, that really captured my imagination. And I read physics because I wanted to be an astronaut. No previous experience required. Get to wear fun uniforms, you know, and do all this stuff. And I've kind of retained an interest in science, but even more in technology, innovation, progress, moving the world forward.
And George, being so outspoken, your views have sometimes led to you falling out with people, even friends, over green issues.
Yes. Well, particularly when I decided that actually nuclear power was an essential part of a low-carbon strategy. And bizarrely, and people will think, in the wake of Fukushima. Because what struck me so forcibly at that point was here was a really tatty, old, antiquated plant, one of the oldest in the world, should have been retired some time before, hit by one of the biggest earthquakes ever recorded, one of the biggest tsunamis ever recorded, and no one died.
And you know, but that position cost you friends?
Yes, well, one friend in particular, a very good friend. I'd known him for many years, and he just flatly refused to talk to me after that. And I tried very hard to amend that situation and to say, look, damn it, this is an energy technology we're arguing about. This is not, you know, not about us. This is not about those bonds of friendship, but it was immovable. I did find that very hard.
And James, I think you recently have also faced some pretty strong reactions to your views on this occasion, actually about fracking.
I'm always losing friends, Matthew, but I went down to Lewis to present a pro-fracking position with certain conditions. I made the mistake of wearing a suit. I'm never going to do that again. And I found myself subjected to a chorus of abuse from about 180 people in a church hall on a Sunday night, from which I was quite lucky to get out without violence. And I appreciate that passions run high, but I suggested that, you know, fracking shouldn't take place everywhere, but we need to experiment with it. And a woman leapt up and said, striking a topical note, "You want to experiment with my six-year-old son?" So already I was in, you know, the rogue's gallery for that most dangerous of offences, you know, hurting children.
And I sense that both of you, when you face people abusing you for your position, it tends to make you feel even more strongly convinced that you need to stick to it.
Well, I think it has both impacts, actually, that it does introduce doubt, and I do spend a lot of time fretting away at the positions I take, with the result that sometimes I've changed them and caused myself even more grief. But yes, I mean, it kind of depends on the nature and the tenor of what's being thrown at you. If someone's giving you a strong argument and you find it hard to contest that argument, well, then that's going to weaken your resolve. But if someone's just screaming at you, that tends to strengthen it.
The abuse in Lewis didn't lead you to questioning your view on fracking.
Well, it was so abusive, and quite a lot of it was personal, that, you know, I tend to sort of be reinforced in my view. But like George, and like anybody who's any good, you know, if somebody's got a good argument, one's always got to address the strongest arguments of one's opponents, I think it's fair to say, rather than the weakest ones. And you know, when I see a strong argument going against me, I do fret like George, and I go away and check again. And as Keynes memorably said, I thought this might come up, but I got the right quote somewhere here. You know, the Baudelaireisation of the quote is, "When the facts change, I change my mind." And I think we've all got to do that from time to time.
Great. Well, that's a fantastic way to move on to the issue itself, fracking. Hydraulic fracturing has been used for extracting oil and gas for decades. In fact, there are already 200 onshore wells. But fracking first hit the headlines in 2007, when the company Quadrilla was granted an exploration licence along the coast of Lancashire for a different type of gas, shale gas. So, to start us off, we've asked you both to prepare a short statement of your respective positions on this issue. George, over to you first.
I accept that some of the claims about fracking, especially the danger of earthquakes and the poisoning of groundwater, have been exaggerated. But in other respects, the argument against it is very strong. The damage to landscapes that are loved by local people, the noise, the lights, the dust, the lorries trundling back and forth, these concerns are hard to ignore if you have any feeling for people and place. But even more important is the contribution it makes to global warming. Fossil fuel companies have already found far more oil and gas and coal than we can safely burn, and the more we add to that stockpile, the more severe global warming is likely to be. The only certain means of preventing man-made climate breakdown is to leave most available fossil fuels in the ground, 80% of them according to one estimate. So the last thing we need is an industry that makes even more oil and gas available for exploitation, which of course fracking does. The counter-argument is that gas is a bridging fuel which allows us to make a transition away from burning coal. And I agree that the need to stop burning coal is even more urgent than the need to stop burning gas. But gas is a transition from coal in the same way as banoffee pie is a transition from chocolate fudge cake. It's not quite as bad for you, but it will still do you in. There's no mystery about how to solve our energy problems. The first step should be a reduction in our amazingly wasteful use of fuel. There are plenty of ways of generating electricity which don't require either coal or gas. Governments have promised for years that we will make a genuine transition from chocolate fudge cake and banoffee pie to a low-carb or low-carbon diet. But the lobbying power of the coal and gas and oil industries seems to be stronger than politicians' resolve. Fracking and its bogus justifications push the promise even further away. It doesn't help us to get out of fossil fuels, but further into them.
Thank you, George. Now, James, it's your turn.
More than coal and more than electric batteries, gas and oil pack an enormous energy punch. And the world needs a lot more gas and oil to heat homes, cook cleanly in homes, apply heat in industry, and power its motor vehicles. Conserving energy won't cut it. Even with today's slump, the demand for fuels has stayed remarkably resilient in the UK, the US, and Germany. In China and India, where full urbanisation and motorisation are still to come, demand for gas and oil will be unstoppable for many years. Fracking should be renamed horizontal drilling for shale gas and oil. By drilling horizontally, one can reach much larger quantities of hydrocarbons than normal. That confers an enormous advantage in terms of the productivity of energy supply. It's that productivity advantage, afforded by drilling that's guided by the very latest IT sensors, which makes me favour drilling for shale, not in every location, but certainly on principle. Productivity increases should lower the cost of energy, even if the vagaries of the market may impede that process. Like other high-tech industries, shale is very safe. To ensure that it's regulated with scrupulous attention to safety, however, we cannot rely on the goodwill of regulators. Only our political vigilance can guarantee judicious and proportionate regulation. In terms of local disruption, householders should be fully compensated for that. However, the home-owning classes must accept that since 93% of Britain's surface area isn't urban, there are plenty of places where shale should be extracted. Also, because gas-fired electricity plants can be mobilised quickly, they complement intermittent renewable energy very well. That, together with regulation, compensation, and renewables, should make shale acceptable to all.
Thank you, James. So, pretty clear disagreement, but now I'm going to see whether I can get you to agree just what your differences are. There are already thousands of shale gas wells in America. Environmentalists have highlighted issues of pollution, damage to the environment, earthquakes and contamination of groundwater. Anti-fracking groups have sprung up in communities all over Britain. In 2012, when it was proposed to drill a well near the small village of Balcombe in West Sussex, the residents were ready.
A peaceful start to the day as protesters and police chatted over breakfast. But all that was soon to change.
People do not want this. You destroyed everything. Please don't do this.
The day's first delivery of equipment to this woodland site, earmarked for test drilling by a fracking company, and the day's first arrest.
Wait.
Protesters here are trying to stop these lorries from entering the site, but the company Quadrilla say they're simply test drilling for oil at this stage and say they have no immediate plans to start the controversial process of fracking.
The government is rushing through this policy, definitely, without consultation. There's been little consultation here. There's been little consultation countrywide. People here are united in saying we need to be looking at renewable sources now. This dash for gas is only going to last 20 or 30 years, and then we're still going to be saying, where is our energy coming from?
So let's start with what may be the most fundamental question. Do we need shale gas at all? James, you're a professor of forecasting and innovation. Do we need shale gas?
Well, I think we've got to accept that we're not just talking about electricity generation here. We're talking about heat in industry. We're talking about gas central heating. We're talking about cooking. And rather importantly, we're talking about transport. And shale gas for the heating and cooking and shale oil for the transport don't have immediate substitutes. I love electric cars, and I want to see more of them and faster, and I very much favour the technological development of them. But the rate of growth is fast, but from a very low base, and it's going to be a very long time before electric vehicles take the place of petrol-driven ones. And, you know, if you compare an internal combustion engine with an electric battery, there's a lot more clout in the petrol-driven car.
George Monbiot, as an environmental campaigner, in a moment you'll tell us why you disagree with that perspective. But just for the moment, having heard James's view, what do you understand as being the essence of his argument?
That there's rising global demand, that we have energy-dense fuels in the form of oil and gas. These are particularly useful for transport and for heating, which are harder to substitute than the simple generation of electricity is, and that we encounter a world of less convenience and more cost if we switch away from fossil fuels or seek to do so.
So is there anything, George, in James's account which you can agree with?
Well, I agree with the basic physics of it, that these are energy-dense fuels, oil and gas, and that that creates a problem in substituting them because they are so fantastically easy and convenient, and the easy and convenient thing is to just carry on with what we've been doing. Though I do also believe that there are good technological substitutes already.
Which I guess brings us on to your own view about whether or not we need shale gas at all, George.
I strongly believe that we don't. And in fact, we need not to need it very badly indeed, because we already have far too much fossil fuel available. The estimate is that if we want to prevent more than 2 degrees of global warming worldwide, we'll have to leave all but 20% of the currently discovered reserves in the ground. And so any technology which increases the amount of reserves beyond the current 100%, which we can't afford to burn, well, that pushes us even further down the slope where we don't want to go. So how do we get by without shale gas, or indeed with less fossil fuel altogether, much less fossil fuel that I believe we need to burn? Well, for a start, there are lots of different ways of generating electricity which are quite viable. Nuclear power is one. The various renewables, put them all together and they can work pretty well together. And I feel we need to be expanding that electricity sector in order to start substituting for transport fuel and for domestic heat, substituting those fossil fuels that we currently use. And this is not rocket science. This is really very simple indeed. It just takes a bit of political will. And the principal political will that's required is not so much pushing the new technologies through as putting a cap on the old technologies, standing up to the power of the fossil fuel industry and saying, I'm sorry, but basically we're going to strand those assets. We're not going to allow you to pull them out of the ground. We're not going to allow you to keep adding to our problem, because we're going to create some space for the new technologies to come in and fill.
James, obviously you don't agree with George, but are there elements of what he's said, the concerns that he's expressed, that you do agree with?
Yeah. I think I don't agree with the term stranded assets and so on, but I think that the dominant fossil fuel in terms of both reserves and emissions around the world is coal. And therefore, if you are worried about the CO2 of coal, the carbon dioxide, it's important to try to get some other high-density fuels as an alternative. The argument then moves on to, and I'm sure we'll deal with that, just how much of an advantage, if any, does gas have over, shale gas in particular, have over coal as a source of electricity. And I believe that it does have advantages in terms of CO2 and in terms of the output that it can generate. So, you know, my question to George is, people are using coal a great deal, India, Poland, all around the world. Coal's had a bit of a revival and Germany's importing it from America. That is very bad in terms of the greenhouse gas effect, and we need an alternative rapidly, and the alternative's in front of us.
My sense, George, is that you would accept James is right that shale gas may be better than coal, but your view would be that better is neither.
Well, I certainly agree with James that coal is the number one priority for getting rid of, because it's got more carbon per unit of energy in than gas has got, but it also burns less efficiently. And the overall impact of that is that you're producing about twice as much carbon dioxide per unit of energy burning coal as burning gas. If we look at our situation in Britain, if you got rid of all the coal burning in Britain, you would take about 10-15% of the carbon dioxide that we're producing out of the equation, which is fine. But then what do you do? You know, we've got an obligation to, by law, to cut our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% against the 1990 levels. Where does the rest of it come from? And the danger is we then have a gas-driven economy where we get locked into gas, because you build a gas plant, it lasts for 40 or 50 years, and you've made all the cuts you possibly can by getting rid of the coal. Maybe there's a few efficiencies, a few little tweaks along the way, but you're not going to get anywhere near the level of cuts required if the UK is going to do its bit working towards a global target of no more than 2 degrees of global warming.
OK, well, thank you both. Can I have a go now at summarising what it is you might agree that you differ on in relation to this part of the argument? James, your view is that we definitely need shale gas, partly as an alternative to coal, and that it can be a bridge to a more sustainable energy model. And George, Your view is that there are already viable alternatives to fossil fuel reserves and that accessing shale gas will mean that we continue to ignore the need for fully sustainable solutions. Is that a reasonable description?
Not quite, I fear. I mean, first of all, for me, the starting point is that, as George has correctly recorded my position, that there's a booming world demand for energy. And in that respect, I fear that coal is going to be around for a long time and it will be very important, remains important for India and China.
Right, so your view is we need shale gas as well as coal, but you still see it as something which could be a bridge to...
No, I didn't say that either. I think that's a little bit glib. I think that... George is right, gas is a more efficient means of electricity generation. The issue then becomes, is shale gas really less bad for the atmosphere and the greenhouse effect than coal? I believe it is, and that isn't to say that I think gas should be the only source of energy. I'm very much in favour of the technological development of renewables. I'd like to see a revival of nuclear in the West, where we've really lost the plot. And I would also like to see carbon capture and storage as far as it's possible. So we need all sources of energy supply to deal with the booming demand that's to come.
So, George, James has slightly clarified his position, but are you reasonably happy with the way in which I've portrayed yours, which is that there are viable alternatives to fossil fuels and that accessing shale gas will distract us from where we should be focusing our energy?
It'll distract us, but it'll also lock in the fossil fuel economy, and then it would make it much harder to make that transition.
OK, well, thank you both for that part of the conversation. Let's move on now to a second area of disagreement. One of the great fears of those opposed to fracking is that it could contaminate groundwater supplies with the methane gas that's being drilled for. These fears have been fueled by some spectacular videos on the internet of people in the US lighting the water that comes out of their taps.
I can often hold a standard kitchen match to my water, and like I said, it is unpredictable, but the methane randomly travels with the water, and sometimes it will light quite spectacularly. Just like that.
Our water was good before they started drilling, and when they got done, it was bad.
Obviously, we have a problem here.
All right, here we go. Oh!
Oh! Alberta water. Ha! Crazy.
This is a relatively new technology. The science is developing. The impact is still being assessed. Now, I'm sure you can both quote various studies, but I want to look at it another way. Is the difference between you, on the one hand, is it safe? And on the other hand, is it safe enough? James, that's a calculation of risk. Why is it you think that people focus so much on the risks?
Well, I think it goes way beyond shale gas and oil. I think today, since the end of the Cold War, there are so many problems around the world and there is so little to distinguish the major political parties that risk and aversion to the future and a certain decadent contentment with our living standards and our lifestyles today makes us completely unwilling to go to the moon, to redevelop supersonic transport, to put the investment in energy research and development that I would like to see. And, you know, if you look at the plurality of medical risks, for example, Matthew, you know, we're all supposed to be dying all the time of food additives and obesity and all the rest of it, and yet we've never lived longer. We've never been healthier. So, you know, it's very hard to believe that we're all on the edge of a precipice from the health and safety point of view. And I tend to believe the same of shale gas and oil. In certain situations, the geology, the local living conditions and all the rest of it needs to be very carefully attended to. And I said in my opening statement, we're talking principles here, not particular locations. But I think on the whole, you know, we tend to inflate and exaggerate risks far too much.
George, you've already told us that you see that some of the claims about contamination of water may be exaggerated, but I wonder, is there anything in what James has said about our kind of risk-averse culture that you agree with?
I think it applies to some things and not to other things, and this is what I find really interesting about our culture in this respect, and is that there are some things we become absolutely obsessed about, you know, and terrorism is a good example. I mean, very low risk individually of terrorism, and yet it's justified from the government point of view, this mass surveillance and all sorts of other intrusive measures, really strong regulation of the citizen. And at the same time, corporations have been greatly deregulated, often enhancing risk to people, and particularly the risk of climate change, which is, you know, this really huge potential problem, a really huge problem already in some parts of the world.
James, just tell me, what did you hear George say there?
Well, on the risks that are inflated or exaggerated, especially terrorism, I think he's entirely right about that. You know, there are, I think, 80 deaths a day, if I'm not mistaken, from car accidents in the States, and 40 or 50 from murders, you know, and that just completely knocks terrorism into a cocked hat. I think the other stuff he said was a little more contentious. I mean, first of all, I think we've had liberalisation in energy markets, but not deregulation. I think regulation is a power in the land, in energy, telecoms, all aspects of life today, a bigger power than ever before. Judicious regulation, as I've suggested in my introduction, is fair enough, but I think I know this from my work with major companies. I mean, the first item on their agenda is regulation, and the second is sustainability and corporate social responsibility. The other thing that I don't agree with is that climate change is already a problem, particularly in developing countries. It may be a bit of a problem, but if you look at the number of people in India, Pakistan, Africa who are dying from the use of wood-burning stoves, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of deaths, as World Health Organization figures right now. Now, that's a genuine risk. It's not just a risk, it's happening. So that's something that I very much think shale gas can and should be an alternative to. If you go to Pakistan, they've got a lot of shale there. They've got it in China and in parts of Africa as well.
George, what's your view on this question of risk?
Right. Well, I mean, I would agree with James that wood-burning stoves are a disaster for people's health, also, of course, for the local environment, because it causes a massive loss of trees and all the problems with soil erosion and destruction of watersheds, which accompanies that. But, of course, these are countries we're talking about which have an awful lot of sunshine falling on them, and solar panels, I think, are a fantastic substitute for that, especially when you've got huge parts of the population which are off-grid. On the issue of regulation, I would agree that when it comes to, say, the safety of oil rigs, that the regulation is pretty intense. It has a few flaws, but, you know, it's generally quite tight. When it comes to the regulation of the stuff which the oil rigs are producing and the burning of that stuff, then by comparison to the scale of risk which vast numbers of well-respected scientists are talking about, it's very lax indeed. I'm talking about climate change.
OK, I want to try to get to the point at which we can see whether we can agree what we differ on in relation to this issue of risk. I think you're both going to have to help me slightly. James, what I'm hearing for you is that essentially the whole debate about risk is part of a kind of wider problem of a suspicion of innovation. And George, what you're saying is that specific risks may be exaggerated, but what's really going on is a continued failure to face up to the big risk. Climate change, as far as you're concerned. Is there something that you can kind of agree about in this domain?
I think we might be able to agree on this, that our assessment and approach to risk should be based on the best possible information and science, and that often it's true that people on my side of the divide have sort of run off with ideas that things are more dangerous than they subsequently turn out to be. And that actually doesn't do us any favours, and it doesn't do the people we're trying to reach any favours either. And I hope that that's one thing we could agree on.
James, that's a good offer to you.
Well, yes, it is. And obviously we should take into account the best evidence that science can provide. But I think what that perspective neglects is that it's only through experimentation that we can improve the science. And it's through taking risks that we can learn new stuff and learn what not to do. For example, if you take Werner Forssmann, who was a German doctor who was the first person to insert a catheter in a human heart, his own. And the science was telling him, as George would call it, not to do that. His department chief told him not to do it. But he went ahead and did it, and the result is a massive improvement in heart surgery.
I would completely agree that within the field of scientific inquiry and discovery, we should be taking risks. That's absolutely right. But this is a planet we're experimenting with. We don't have a control experiment and a control for the experiment in the form of another planet where we're not doing it. And we don't have a way of ending the experiment if it runs away with us.
So James, I think George has given away quite a lot. I think people listening to this debate will be surprised in a way that he's recognising that some of the concerns about fracking may be exaggerated, some of those risks. But he's inviting you to say that, let's face it, climate change is a very big risk. It is different from many other kinds of risks.
Well, the trope that we're engaged in a planetary experiment belongs to Margaret Thatcher in 1988, actually.
Well, it doesn't really matter where it came from.
Well, it does matter.
I'm saying, George is suggesting that you can agree, what you can agree about is that risk assessment should be based upon the best science and technology that we know and on the kind of scale, the proportion of the risk. Is that something that you agree about, even if your risk assessment might differ?
Well, I agree that climate change is a risk. And, you know, we started off, I think, both wanting to pay great attention to greenhouse gas emissions. And that's one of my arguments for the superiority of what's called fracking, but horizontal drilling, over coal. So I want to see that move out of coal as fast as possible, with the caveat that, you know, a lot of countries will still need coal.
So you might exempt concerns about climate change from your general view that risks are exaggerated. In this area, there is a genuine risk that we should explore.
Yes, but, there's a risk that all sorts of terrible things could happen as soon as I leave the studio.
OK, thank you. Let's move on to our third area. We've talked about risk, and at the heart of that is a cost-benefit analysis. Who gets the rewards? Who pays the price, and how should they be compensated? But how do you calculate that question? Communities, of course, have the right to try to protect their local environment. At the same time, we've always adapted the environment for the sake of progress and in the national interest. The Prime Minister David Cameron, visiting a fracking site, says there'll be wins all round.
Nothing would go ahead if there were environmental dangers. I think people can be reassured by that. But I actually believe it's when these wells go ahead, when people start to see the benefit, when they see there aren't environmental concerns, they will see that it's quite right that this is part of our long-term economic plan. We're saying as soon as a well is dug, the local community should get £100,000. They should get 1% of the revenues over the life of that well. That could be up to £10 million per well. And today we're announcing that the local council should keep 100% of the business rates. That could be £2 million, £3 million every year.
George, accepting that you don't think we need this fuel at all, David Cameron clearly thinks that people's environmental concerns can be fully compensated financially. Do you think he's right?
You could say compensated, you could say bought off, couldn't you? It sounds like a pretty straightforward bribe. Of course, even if we were to be able to say these two things are commensurable, you can lose the landscape quality and have this noise and light and dust and truck movements in your life, and you get X amount of money in return for that, and the one compensates for the other, which is something I would dispute. You're only compensating people at the local level, whereas the biggest problem, of course, with fossil fuels is what happens to everybody. People far from us on the other side of the world who've got no say in this whatsoever and are likely to be far more vulnerable to climate change because they live in already more extreme environments than we do, and, of course, to future generations. And how do you compensate them? I mean, how could money possibly be a compensation for the huge disruptive changes which might take place? What would money be worth in those circumstances? So I feel that what we've got here are incommensurable values, that there are things which we are in grave danger of losing for which money cannot compensate.
James, what do you think George has just said?
Well, he's moving the argument from the local level, where he doesn't think there's so much of a problem except for the landscape and all of that. And I agree, let's not drill in Snowdonia or whatever it is, to the global level. But I come back again that there are already hundreds of thousands of people dying, and George agreed with this, from the wrong kinds of fuels. And gas has advantages over coal in terms of climate. So I think we're, you know, back to where we were on that. I would say that, I don't know what George's view is on this, but I don't buy cost-benefit analysis. You know, if you look at the cost-benefit analysis for High Speed 2, it was widely the subject of ridicule, and very properly. So I don't think you can just, you know, put a price on everything and understand the value of nothing, to paraphrase Wilde.
Let me try putting it this way.
Please.
What George is saying is that this is not simply an issue of local interests, which can be, as it were, bought off or whatever, but this is an issue of global interest. I wonder whether, James, in a sense you agree with him that it's not just a matter of local interest, but view it is an issue of national interest in terms of our need for energy.
Yeah, well, you know, the difference that Britain can make to climate change by banning fracking, along with all the other bans that are so sought after nowadays, is very, very modest. I mean, if you compare our energy usage with that of China, you know, it's enormously nationalistic, in my view, to believe that we are there to set an example, that the example that we set will really make a difference, that other nations must follow our lead. I think that's just hubristic.
Sure.
It's curious here, because we sort of agree that Britain shouldn't be place itself in that position. We agree that we should sort of step away from our colonial past and no longer see ourselves as the world leaders and the rest of it, but we draw completely different conclusions from that position. And as I understand it, James's conclusion is that we should not then say we should do our bit to cut our global emissions as much as possible. Mine is that leads inexorably to the position that we should do our bit.
My sense is that you both recognise that local communities have a right to express their views and have a right in some ways to be compensated for whatever happens to them. But in a way, the focus here isn't really the local or even the national, but it's the international. And on the international front, George, you want to see international cooperation to reduce the use of fossil fuels. Your focus, James, is on international cooperation in order to develop new scientific and technological solutions. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it's very interesting, Matthew, that, you know, the phrase technological fix is always said with a sneer, you know, but if it wasn't for technological fixes, we wouldn't be in this studio.
George, you wouldn't object to a technological fix.
I would say it's a fair account, but actually I agree with the need for the technological innovation as part of the package of reducing our use of fossil fuels.
Are you with George now, James?
Well, I think, you know, George is perhaps being, in a very honest to and fro here, a bit disingenuous, because part of what I think George favours is very...
No, the one rule we have here is you're not allowed to say what you think George believes. No,
well, all right. One of the ways of reducing fossil fuel use in developing countries, as here, is a way that I don't agree with, which is to call for decreases in consumption. So we just had recently Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat energy minister, say that, you know, one of the ways forward now is, or his department, is to buy smaller TVs and to buy smaller fridge freezers and so on. And I think this is really, it really is an example of the hair shirt philosophy. What we need, especially in developing countries, but even among the poor, the 50 million Americans who are below the poverty line, for example, is more consumption. They deserve a better fridge and a bigger TV. So I think it's nice to look for increases in energy efficiency, but the fact is that you can increase it as much as you like, the demand for it is still going to go up.
So we've got a long way from local fracking, but I think we're close to agreement here, I think. George, just clarify this point. When you say that internationally there should be, we should work together to reduce fossil fuels, are you saying we should also have to reduce consumption?
It depends entirely on where you are. I believe in countries like this one, we use energy in a fantastically wasteful way, and we could greatly reduce consumption without affecting our quality of life. I feel that in the very poor countries, there's a clear need for an increase in energy consumption and energy production. But what I would love to see us do in the rich world is actually provide some proper funding to allow countries to explore their fantastic ambient energy resources like solar and wind and wave and whatever else it might be, which could produce tremendous gains in human development, but also without compromising the ability of the living world to keep people at a decent standard of living.
Willing to accept that, James?
Well, no, because I think the poor already have austerity. That's the programme of the government. And a lot of people are finding it really hard to make ends meet. So unless we're oblivious to the poor in what used to be called the first world, you know, America, Germany, Britain and so on, calls for a decrease in consumption are extremely unproductive.
So I'm going to have one last go at this before we finish. I think you both agree that this is something which we need to look at an international level. My sense is that George's focus is almost completely on how do we work internationally to reduce fossil fuel consumption, and that involves the rich world taking more of a hit in order that standard living can rise in the poorer world. And also, George's view is that we can be much more energy efficient in this country. Your view, James, is that we should work internationally to explore science and technology, but any attempt to reduce consumption, including in this country, in the end is unnecessary and will hurt the poorest most. Is that a reasonable summary of your positions?
I would say that it's partly a reasonable summary. I would add that I, too, am very keen to see the best science and technology deployed to help us get out of fossil fuels. And I don't see those two things as being incompatible. And I think if James and I can agree on anything, surely it is that. Surely it is that we are both in favour of innovative new energy solutions. And why not the innovative new energy solutions which don't produce carbon dioxide? What greater aim can there be?
James, help
the technology
me out.
Help that James
me out.
Loves?
Surely now you can agree with George.
Well, I've already said I'm in favour of nuclear
good.
And renewables.
Good. That's good you've got that. We kind of moved a long way away from the local issue. I think, in a way, can we just be clear that we do actually agree on that, which is to say that we should respect local views, but in the end, local opposition cannot be allowed to trump whatever is necessary at the national or international level. You would both agree about that?
I feel that it should be part of the mix, and that we can't just trample over local communities and say we're going to ignore your views altogether. But
they must be weighed in the balance.
They have to be weighed in the balance,
correct.
And there has to
and
be.
You'd
the
agree
global,
with that,
the global element.
So you're neither of you sympathetic to NIMBYism.
No.
Great. Well, thank you both very much. So if you think that we do need more fossil fuel, that we systematically exaggerate risks, and that international action on energy and climate change should not stand in the way of growth, maybe you should be getting out and investing in shale gas now. If, on the other hand, you think that we don't need more fossil fuels, that we aren't facing up still to the risks of climate change, and that the overriding priority of international action should be cutting fossil fuel use, then maybe you should be at your local anti-fracking protest. I'm sure you at home will continue to disagree on all these issues. But hopefully now, after listening to James Woodhousen, George Monbiot and me, Matthew Taylor, you're all a little bit clearer on what you agree you disagree about. Good night.